Good morning, and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Justin Taylor, author of the new novel Reboot from Pantheon Books. Justin's previous books include the memoir Writing with a Ghost, the novel The Gospel of Anarchy, and two story collections, Everything Here is the Best Thing Ever and Flings. His work has appeared in Harper's, The New Yorker, Bomb, and Book Forum, among other publications, and he's a contributing writer to the Washington Post Book World and the director of the Sewanee School of Letters. Please join us for our conversation with Justin, which is already in progress. Well, Justin, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios just a few days after launching the new novel at Powell's Books in Portland.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, speaking of Powell's, that's where we met for the first time face-to-face a few months ago. I had just read your memoir, Writing with a Ghost, and loved it. I recognized you from the book jacket photo and brazenly introduced myself to talk about it. So given the memoir, I'd like to start with a little about your life story. Reboot's narrator is David Crater, a child actor who enjoyed some celebrity as the co-star of a fictional TV series, Rev Beach. And you are also a child actor, getting your start in commercials.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I was born in North Miami Beach, you know, part of South Florida, where a lot of fashion, photography, and some commercials, some film, there's a lot of that business down there. And my mother heard about it when I was an infant, I think, through someone in a new mother's group, that you could make a little extra money if, you know, the baby was in the picture. And the way that she always told the story is this woman she'd met said sometimes you even got to keep the clothes. And that was very exciting for her. My parents were pretty broke at the time, so they just gave it a shot. And I guess it worked out.
You were a few months old?
Yeah, I think about 6 months old. I mean, she was literally holding me in the first photos. I mean, I was not, you know, couldn't sit up. And one of the side effects of that, she ended up getting a job on Miami Vice because she was in the photos. So she got cast out of the thing. She was an extra. She was often in the back of the head. You'd see the back of her head when Crockett and Tubbs were walking through their office.
So you've seen her on TV then?
Well, I mean, I was a kid. I mean,
oh,
I was
no,
a toddler
in,
running
in
around.
In reruns.
This. Yeah, yeah, we have some of them on video. Oh. I haven't seen all of it, but yeah, I've seen that.
And then I think you were in a few movies too. There was one radio. What was it?
Radio Inside.
Yeah, but I don't know. Was it released? I was looking in IMDb, and I wasn't able to determine.
It was. It was. It had been. Yeah, it was supposed to get a film release. They thought it was going to be in theaters, and then it ended up going straight to Showtime, I think, and then to home video after that. I had a copy of the VHS. I may still have it somewhere. I actually don't know whether it ever made it to DVD. It was a little indie film. It was a kind of sweet story about these two brothers and their father. And I played the older brothers.
As a kid, right?
As a kid, yeah. the flashback to his younger self. Yeah, and that movie I was in, I mean, it can't be 7-8 minutes of screen time total, if that. But it's, you know, it's a few different flashbacks over the course of the film. The other one I was in was a Sean Connery movie called Just Cause, and that I was actually cut from. My scene was the original cold open of the film. I played the lead Boy Scout. These Boy Scouts are combing the Everglades to find this missing girl. I was the one who found the body and screamed about it. And they ended up cutting it from the film, but they used it in the trailer. So the one time I ever saw myself on a movie screen was the trailer for Just Cause ran with, I think it was Interview with the Vampire. It might have been Disclosure, one of those movies of that era. And whatever it was something I should not have even been watching at that age. But I went and saw it in the theater 3 or 4 times because it was the only way to see myself. You see yourself for 5 seconds and then sit there for 2 hours.
But still, it must be exciting to see yourself on the big screen like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it was a great thrill. I mean, and it never happened again, which is why I had to make up a whole book about it.
Now, in Reboot, the child actor, the fictional child actor, David, remembers his own days as an actor. When starting out in L.A., he says, quote, "There was a part of me that loved what I was doing, the hunger and drive of it, the feeling that my parents needed me to be good enough and to keep getting better, bigger." Was that your feeling, too, when you were a kid there living in? It was like a residence, like an apartment complex for child actors, right?
Yeah, I never lived anywhere like that.
Okay, that's just fictional. That's in the book.
Yeah, those places exist. I never lived in one, but there are a few of them out in L.A. There was one in particular that I had read a nonfiction book. Part of it took place there, and so I kind of based mine on that. But that the passage you read, that feeling, no, I would never say I exactly felt that way. My parents were very supportive. They were not competitive or hectoring. They did not have their own ambitions kind of tied up with mine. You know, they wanted me to do well. It was something that I'd always done, and they thought that, you know, making the money was a very nice thing. You know, especially at times when money was tight, they didn't spend what I made. They put it all aside. I mean, it's basically what I went to college on. And it was never a huge amount of money, but they did understand that if things had gone a slightly different way, there were real chances to have very big breaks. I mean, you know, in those days, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, you know, there were some real movies that I was in pretty close competition to get cast in. I had a callback or two for a role in The Sandlot.
Wow.
I would have been in The Good Son, but for a guy named Elijah Wood. He kind of ate my lunch on that one. But no, I was really, as far as I know, maybe it's family lore, but my understanding is that I was the second to him. And that if he had not done it for whatever reason, it would have been me and Macaulay. I guess we'll never know. But it was a bunch of things like that. And so they were very aware that there was an opportunity perhaps best not passed up, but they were definitely not trying to force it. And when I kind of wanted to stop doing it, you know, around age 12, 13, 14, my dad in particular was reluctant to see me give it up because I think he felt it was such a unique thing and it would be something that would be hard to get back. But again, he never pushed the issue. So the feeling described in the book, you know, that David's talking about, that was much more based on some celebrity memoirs that I read, particularly by former child actors who from a very young age were earning sometimes 6 and 7 figures. And you know, from the time they were 10 years old, felt that they were supporting their entire family. You know, mom's working full time as my manager and we bought another house and I really can't afford to do this. And how that shaped so much of their childhood and adolescence, that pressure.
Yeah, I looked up some of those. One you read was by Dustin Diamond called Saved. He was in Saved
Behind
by the Bell.
Yeah, Behind the Bell.
Behind the Bell. It was a tell-all, apparently so scandalous that the publisher dropped him and he self-published. And then another one by Corey Feldman titled Choreography. Very clever. So some of those books, some of the content of the books worked their way into Reboot.
Yeah, absolutely. I read those books pretty closely. And so in some cases, I tried not to take anything directly from any one person's life. But the reason I read a few of them was to kind of see these patterns and to get a sense of the scope of what was possible in these worlds. Another one I would mention is Jodie Sweetin's memoir, Unsweetened.
Oh, I don't think I know her.
She was the middle daughter on Full House.
Oh, okay.
And she's got some incredible stories. She's someone who battled addiction very intensely in her teens and 20s. She tells this amazing story about trying alcohol for the first time at Candace Cameron's wedding. Candace, who played her older sister. And someone like gave her a shot of something and that was the last thing she remembered. You know, she just, you know, how do you know at 14 that you're a person who just can't stop? So there's a bunch of stories like that.
And David is somewhat of a recovering alcoholic in the book.
He is. Yeah, he's had addiction issues, as again, almost all of these people have. I mean, I won't say every single one, but it certainly comes up in all three of the memoirs that I just named and a bunch of others that I could name or, you know, just in the narratives of these kind of people. I think that the intense pressure that comes with being that kind of public figure, and especially at that young of an age, you know, people look for ways to shut themselves off and protect themselves, and chemicals are one way to do it. And the other part of it is you become a person to whom nobody can say no, which is really in some ways what David thinks about. You know, he's always the guy that wants to keep the party going, and people really want to be able to say that they partied with him. So they're always trying to get him going. And it takes a lot in that kind of circumstance.
It's a lot about celebrity culture in the book. Yeah. I want to talk, go back a little to the memoir, Writing with the Ghost, which was focused on your dad, Larry. You write in the book about his failed suicide attempt and periods of depression, but also what came out for me, and I think almost every reader, was his love and support for you and your own deep love for him. The new novel, Reboot, is a fictional memoir written by David Crater, fictional character. Why'd you structure the novel as a memoir, and how did your own memoir influence the new book?
That's a great question. The answer to the first part, why did I structure this as a memoir? I didn't intend to originally. I worked on this book for almost 10 years, and it's been through a number of failed drafts that took all sorts of different shapes. There was, you know, a version that was written entirely in the third person, like Roth's Zuckerman Unbound. There was a version that was in multiple third persons, you know, like Dickens or something, where you're jumping around character to character.
And none of it worked. And your first novel was multiple viewpoints also.
Yes. Yeah. At one point I had tried to basically do over what I had done in The Gospel of Anarchy, and it just didn't work. This wasn't that kind of story. So, you know, a large part of the process of writing this was just embracing David's voice and figuring out who he was and what vantage point he was telling the story from. And I let him make a few jokes about the idea of a celebrity memoir. And then I thought, at first he was saying it sarcastically. And then I thought, well, why don't I just let him do it? Why don't I just have that be the thing? And that was really fun.
Was that the big breakthrough?
It was one of them. Uh-huh. Yeah, for sure. Because knowing that the book was itself a text, that there wasn't just this kind of suspension of disbelief. Why is this voice talking to me? And being able to say, this is a book that this guy is writing. It gave me a lot in terms of who he thinks his audience is and what he's trying to do, why he will and won't say certain things. He worries constantly about his readers getting bored, because you get the sense he's not someone who's read a whole lot. And sometimes, you know, he doesn't really think he should be spending as much time as he is on giving you certain information, but he kind of knows you need it, but he feels guilty because it's boring. So that was all in there. To the second part of your question, how do the novel and the memoir relate to each other? I find them very deeply related. I don't think I would have ever written Reboot if I hadn't written Riding with the Ghost. I think this novel answers the memoir in a certain way. That book was so open, and I tried to make it as honest as possible, and it's really quite sad. You know, it was a terrible thing my father went through, and the grief that I went through, and all that. And I had never done confessional writing in that way, and I tried to be so responsible to all the parties involved and open, like I said, and just, you know, just get everything right. And so after having done that, I just wanted to do something that was fun, fast,
funny,
a little crazy, that had the freedom to be as irresponsible as it wanted to be, you know, which isn't to say I think the book is entirely silly or disposable.
No.
But I wanted to be able to just screw around, really, to play.
Now, in a recent interview I read, you said, I think of myself as a short story writer. Stories bring me the most pleasure to work on. And we talked about, you have two published novels now, also a screenplay in production.
Yeah.
In the book Reboot itself, David writes, because he's the narrator, movies are like poems. You're supposed to experience them in a single sitting, then let them rattle around in your mind long after. TV is like reading a novel or playing a video game or having a roommate. It always wants to keep going, to be more, to give more, to tell more. I was thinking, is that analogy like movies to TV? Could that be applied to, say, short fiction to novels?
Kind of the
short story is working almost as a poem, and then the novel just kind of going wherever you want it to go.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. I believe that to my bones. And when I am in a classroom, that is exactly the way that I teach students the difference between the short story and the novel. I think it's very common to think about stories and novels as having the closest relationship because they're both fiction and because they're both in prose. And so it seems like, oh, there's a little one, there's a big one. But I really don't feel that way. I do think aesthetically, thematically, cosmically, if you want to take it to that level, I think the short story and the poem are very closely aligned. The way that they can treat language, the way that they both sort of maximize what's possible within the very narrow confines of their length. All of it, you know. And of course, there are short novels, there are taught novels, there are language-driven
novels.
Novellas, yeah, sure. I mean, you know, not to say a novel can't do all those things, but it doesn't have to, in the way that I think even a long, dense short story or a long poem has to. And so I often start short fiction classes off by teaching a couple of poems, or maybe we'll do a poem at the top of every class, you know, all semester long or something.
My wife has a theory about movies. The more times they mention the title in the movie, the better the movie is. I don't think that's universal. I can think of several exceptions to that rule. 2001 Citizen Kane, probably. But maybe it applies to the novel. I started circling the appearance of the word reboot in the book. I haven't counted, but it must be close to 100, if not over. And you used it in so many different ways. And of course, that was by design. I think you've said in a past interview that the book is really about repetition, duplicates and repetition.
Yeah, I think it is. Duplicates, repetition, doppelgangers, resurrections. You know, David, he sees a mirror image, a kind of distorted mirror image of himself and his friend Shane, a version of a life he kind of wishes he lives, but also is glad that he didn't. You know, the whole reboot project is this sort of redemption slash reunion. I mean, all these re's, you know, I really did just try to milk as much meaning out of that as I possibly could once I had made the decision to use it.
At one point, a sexual act is referred to as a reboot when David has sex with his ex-wife.
Yes.
Grace.
Yeah. Yeah. And he wonders very openly, you know, is the relationship rebooting along with? Yeah.
And the book itself, I think you've called it a hard reboot. I think because you were talking about the origin story. I have here that you started it on New Year's Day 2014. You were writing longhand for a week. You were failing for the next 7 years, apparently. A lot of hopelessness among the failure. You didn't really know if it was going to work or not. And you were thinking of abandoning the project, well, actually several times, but you didn't. Mm-hmm. What kept you going towards that hard reboot?
Well, I think a lot of times I didn't keep going. I mean, I abandoned this thing a lot of times.
Oh, literally just
really
set it
walked
aside.
Away from it. I mean, there is a passage in Riding with the Ghost where I wrote about this novel and why I had finally given up on it. And I included that in the book because I thought if I put it in print in the true story, that would make it true. Mm-hmm. And it might have stayed that way. I don't know. You know, after Riding with the Ghost, I was doing a lot of other things. I was writing a lot of book criticism. I was starting to do some music journalism and just...
Yes, I read an article on Fish that you...
Yes, yeah. So really kind of stretching my legs a little bit and seeing what was possible. And then, you know, lockdown hit and I was sitting in my home office doing nothing for basically an entire year. I mean, you remember, everyone in Portland remembers we locked down early, we locked down hard. There was nowhere to go. There was nothing to do. And I thought about this project again. And that was when I did what you called the hard reboot, or I guess what I've called the hard reboot too. The rule I made basically was if you're going to go back to this idea, you cannot go back to any of the old material, because I still had the idea in my head, but I really couldn't face at that point a decade's worth of manuscripts and fragments and rewrites and Word docs and what version was this scene in. It just, it was killing me. I was sinking under the weight of it. And
you didn't refer to any of that then?
I didn't.
All the pages you wrote and all the notes?
No, I started fresh and the rule I made was, if you can remember it, you can use it. Otherwise, you got to make it up. No recourse to that old material. And I have a writer friends who've done things like that. Some of them do it all the time. Lauren Groff claims that that's how she writes every novel.
She writes several drafts, throws them away.
Throws them away. And then I don't know how she determines which is the keeper draft. You'd have to ask her. But so I tried a version of that, I guess, that worked for me. I just wrote it as fast as I possibly could.
Yeah, 28 days?
Yeah.
Incredible. So why did this last draft succeed where the others failed?
I don't know. I mean, maybe part of it was paradoxically the freedom afforded by lockdown. You know, I think after a year of being in total stasis and confinement, it was so much fun to create a world that was all about velocity and movement and connection. And, you know, I think there's a kind of dream of, I mean, this book starts after lockdown. You know, I wrote it in March.
Yeah, definitely a post-pandemic book.
Yeah, which couldn't have been possible, you know, at any time
no.
before. And I think maybe that actually lent some urgency to David, and it gave more of a why to what he was doing. That, you know, I wrote the book in March, basically in March of 2021, but I set it in September of that year. So there's a really clear time frame when it was set. And his feeling was very clearly he's lost all this time to the lockdown. And that was when he got the idea to reboot the thing. And, you know, he really is pushing it because he hasn't seen all these people in a long time. And he's trying to get back to his life, basically.
And going to fan conferences. Traveling all over.
He's doing all the things he couldn't do before.
Must be ecstatic, because after 2 years where you couldn't do that.
Yeah.
Now, a character in the book, Molly Webster, who's perhaps the most literate. Mm-hmm. I think she was an English major.
Yeah.
She recites a sonnet by Coleridge in the book. The sonnet's called Duty, Surviving Self-Love, written in 1826. And with apologies to Coleridge, I'm going to read the last three lines, which are in the book. Old friends burn dim like lamps in noisome air. Love them for what they are, nor love them less, because to thee they are not what they were. And you said, Justin, that Reboot would not have existed without this poem. How did the sonnet inspire you?
Yeah, that is absolutely true. I love Coleridge. I love this sonnet. When I'm working on a big project, I often have a few pieces of art that I'm using as lodestones or guiding lights or whatever. And
an art could be a poem, not a graphic or a picture.
Yeah, uh-huh. Absolutely. I mean, very often it is actually a poem. It's mm-hmm. some other piece of writing that I'm kind of shooting toward. And, you know, Kafka, who gives the book one of its epigraphs, is one example of that. I mean, if you read Historia Country Doctor, it's filled with these kind of wild dreams and sharp reversals, and David has a bunch of those. But with regard to this, yeah, Coleridge wrote this poem later in his life after he had gone through the worst of his opiate addiction, but was still struggling with it and had kind of fallen back on the largesse of the Wordsworths to care for him. They'd had a kind of falling out, and this brought them back together, and he was, I think, living with them again. I may butcher some of the biographical details, but so he had that reconnection, but he also felt
Wordsworth wasn't quite the same friend that he made
originally. Yeah, they were a little cooler to him than he would have liked. And part of that might have been because, you know, they were well past the fires of youth and the passions of youth. Wordsworth had become more conservative, you know, in his middle age, politically, artistically. I mean, he really did.
Oh, man, I can relate. I have a friend I've known since junior high, and I would not be friends with him today if we hadn't been friends all these years.
Yeah.
We've drifted in terms of our, he's like to the right now. It's kind of scary.
It happened.
But we're still friends.
Yeah, and so that's really what the poem is about. You know, the first line, unchanged within to see all changed without. That's David. It's David through and through. And the original idea for this book, well before I even came up with the idea of a reboot, was just that it was going to be these alums of this teen drama, in particular these two guys who'd been best friends.
Shane and David,
and then had very divergent careers, and then the girl who'd played the love interest on the show.
Oh, Grace.
Who had been involved with one or both of them. That was the idea. It was always to get them back together for some reason. And this poem was a big part of that. I think it's a really beautiful, poem, and I think it's a really interesting sentiment. There's real wisdom in that. That image of the old friend burning dim like a lamp in bad air. You know?
Noisome, yes.
Yeah. You can really see it, the flame kind of guttering a little bit.
It's right, not sputtering,
that,
yeah.
Yeah, it's not that beautiful, clean flame you get when you turn on the gas. But it's there, right? It's burning. Like, you
right.
know, you can read by it. You can sit with it.
Again, it's a novel. So you could do things that you can't do in a short story, and that's to bring in a whole bunch of interesting subplots. One involves a figure named Cyrus Teed. And he founded a Hollow Earth cult, the Koreshian Unity, in the late 19th century. And his take on Hollow Earth is that we all live in what's called a cosmogonic egg. I thought you made this up because it was so ridiculous. But Cyrus Teed apparently was very real. Mm-hmm. And what you write in the book, nothing is less plausible than the truth. Can you talk about Cyrus and his cosmogonic egg theory? Normally, we think of the hollow earth as going inside the earth, and there's been a lot of fiction like that, like Edgar Allan Poe. But I think cosmogonic egg is we're actually on the inside top of the egg. And we're held in place by, I don't know, a centrifugal force.
Yeah. You got it exactly. They really believed it. They spent a lot of their time trying to develop scientific equipment that would prove that we were on the inner concave surface. And their showcase device actually was just a bunch of sawhorses, like you'd use to block a road.
Uh-huh.
They would go out on the beach in southwestern Florida and set them up for miles. And then they would take these measurements. And their idea was that if they measured long enough, they would see the dip because they would...
Because it's following the curve, the inner curve of the egg.
And every time it didn't do that, they just tried to refine their metrics. Yeah, Cyrus Teed, I've been a fan of Hollow Earth theory really since college. Weirdly, a lot of the stuff in this book, particularly the science fiction stuff, a lot of it comes from one particular class I took at the University of Florida called Eccentric Spaces and Spatialities.
Was the Edgar Allan Poe book in there, The Adventures?
Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket was in there. Journey to the Center of the Earth was in there. But a lot of other things, too. I mean, Marilyn Robinson's Housekeeping was taught to me in that class. Quite a bit of...
Did you do Against the Day, the Pynchon book?
No, we didn't.
Oh, there's a Hollow Earth subplot in there, too.
But it was not a class on Hollow Earth. It was a class on eccentric relationships to space and kind of abnormal spaces in general. And so that's why we did Robinson's Housekeeping. My professor was very interested specifically in the images of sky and water inversion and like the architecture of the house the women live in. He didn't care that it wasn't science fiction. I mean, it's truly bizarre. Anyway, I'm sounds like a long aside, but he's one of the dedicatees of the book, Dr. Terry Harpold. Really the best teacher that I ever had and someone who's been very much a model for my own academic career, how I try to carry myself and, you know, a standard to sort of meet.
And also introducing Hollow Earth to you.
Yes. And a lot. And it's actually incredible how much stuff out of that one class, it just hits you at a certain time in life. And I've been riding off of the 16 weeks I spent with him for 20 years now in various, in various ways. But with Hollow Earth in particular, I knew I wanted like a conspiracy theory in the book. And I was looking at first at things that were kind of in common circulation. And there was that whole flat earth thing a few years ago. And, you know, the space lasers and whatever.
Yes, the Jewish space lasers.
Yeah, yeah.
We never went to the moon. It was all fake.
The moon thing. But I think I didn't want to rehash one that had already been kind of overdone. Because everything else in the book is about reboots and recycling. And I thought this should be something out of the deeper past. So in a sense, it is a reboot, but really it's kind of coming out of nowhere.
That hardly nobody knows about.
Nobody knows about it.
Cyrus Teed.
Yeah, exactly. And so after I decided to set the show in Florida and I was deciding where to put it, I remembered that the Koreshans had been on the Gulf Coast south of Tampa. And then I just said, well, that's it. They shot the show in the same place where these people lived and went from there. And then I learned as much as I could about the Koreshan Unity. I took a research trip there. I visited the grounds. I went to their archives at Florida Gulf Coast University.
Wow. Is there a museum there or anything like that? Or
sort of. So the last Koreshans, I mean, the story of the Koreshans is told in brief in the novel, but the last of them lived until the 1960s. Their numbers dwindled pretty quickly and they were a celibacy cult, so they didn't really have any heirs. Few children were born there, you know, the way these things will go.
Is there a connection to David Koresh?
Well, there's just a connection to the word Koresh. I mean, it's Hebrew. I think it's Hebrew. I think it means king or messiah or something.
Oh, okay, because he had his own cult.
Yeah. I mean, so no connection like between those two guys, but they both chose the name for the same reason. Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, when the last of the Koreshans were dying in the 60s and figuring out what they wanted to do, they negotiated with the state of Florida to cede all their land to the state on the condition that their grounds be preserved and turned into a state park, which they did. And so you can go see their original buildings. You can see, you know, they ran power plants. They built roads. They had a printing press. They had a heavy industrial workshop. I mean, they made all their own farming equipment. For a long time, they were really the major cultural and industrial center of Southwest Florida. Kind of until like Fort Myers and a couple other places started to get settled, you know, other than the natives who, of course, you know, had been there since time immemorial, they were the first people to quote unquote settle the place. And, you know, and they really did. So you can go and see all this stuff and it's really amazing. And so I did. And then I went to the archives.
Did they talk about their cosmogonic egg theory?
Yeah, it's all over the place. I mean, maps of what the solar system looks like as this inner space inside the egg. Teed's, you know, schematics of the New Jerusalem, what he thought it was going to look like. And he thought it was basically going to take up the bottom half of the Florida Peninsula. There was going to be a planned community in his mind, I mean.
Disney World, like, yeah, a, yeah, like yeah. about 100 years previous.
Yeah, or like a Swedenborg kind of, you know. Uh-huh. I mean, that's really what you're dealing with. And then in the archives, you can see all their papers and images. A lot of that stuff's actually online. Anyone can look it up. FGCU has done a fantastic job of making this stuff accessible.
Yeah, I went down the rabbit hole a little and,
oh, good.
And looked at it. But it's interesting that you you just said that you were searching for a conspiracy theory that was not rehashed over and over again. And you have a line in the book about conspiracy theories. A conspiracy theory is always more tempting than the truth, not because it's a simpler story, but because it's a story. And I was thinking the same thing as you, apparently, that myths are like that. They're yeah. easily disproven, I mean, to rational folks. Mm-hmm. And yet they're tempting to believe in because it's a good story.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. It's a kind of video game logic, you know, and video games kind of figure in this also. And I guess a lot of games are more complex now, but the ones I grew up playing, particularly in the 80s and 90s, you know, whatever the boss of the dungeon is can only be defeated with the weapon that's in the chest that's in that dungeon. Mm-hmm. And that seems like a less than... It's not a great way to organize your dungeon if you're the boss. But the game, you know, but the game has to impose this logic of possibility on it that...
To succeed as a game.
To succeed yeah. as a game, yeah. that the people who are... You know, if you imagined those creatures as characters, they obviously wouldn't do, because why would you? And that interplay, I think, is very interesting. And I think that is true of a lot of conspiratorial thinking. You know, people always say, oh, this is illogical. This doesn't, you know, this doesn't make sense. I think that's part of it, too. It invites you to gain a fluency that other people don't have, either because they just don't understand or because you're a believer where they aren't, which is the same thing that, you know, that religion offers. I mean, you know, Kierkegaard, quite famously in Fear and Trembling and elsewhere, talks about the stumbling block, right? That to become a true Christian, to become a believer, there's all these obstacles in your way. It's not rational. It doesn't make sense.
Right, like facts.
Yeah, if it was provable, it wouldn't be worth believing in. There'd be no point, right?
It'd be too easy.
Yeah, and so in a way, you have to believe, you have to want to believe before you can believe. And I was very, I have always been very interested in that kind of logic, which I think in some cases, you know, can be really quite beautiful, and in others can be quite pernicious. And yeah, it's just something I keep going back to. Maybe you see both versions of it in the book.
Yeah, well, I see some of the video game influence, and you've said you've inserted a bunch of Easter eggs in Reboot, and that's
yeah.
a hidden reference that's left up to the reader or the gamer to discover. In light of Passover, which is going on right now, we could also call it an Afikoman.
Yeah.
The middle matzah that's hidden from the kids. I think the concept originated in video games, isn't it? Easter eggs. And how has, besides what you said, Justin, how has it influenced the book? And of course, there's a fictional video game in the book itself called Shibboleth Gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say it influenced the book, and video games influenced the book in a few different ways. I mean, one is just that I've always been a gamer. I like playing games. In particular, I like a big sprawling RPG. I don't play any games that require you to go online. I don't want to do anything multiplayer. I don't want to play head-to-head or be on teams with people, because I'm enough of an addictive personality that it would become my entire life. And so what I really like is an offline game that I have to myself, and it's a big world and I can go through it at my own pace. So, you know, all the recent Zelda games, or to go back a little further, the, you know, Final Fantasy games for Super Nintendo or Skyrim, you know, a lot of different examples you can think of. And for me, I find it very meditative. I get a lot of good thinking done while I'm doing that, because it takes a lot of time, but a lot of it is actually quite repetitive. It's a little silly. You spend a lot of time just mowing down monsters to get your next level, or harvesting enough whatever to make your potion. So I really, you know, I like it also because it's not text. I mean, my life is text, and I love literature and I love text, but I read for pleasure. I write for pleasure. I read for work. I write for work. I read student work. I teach text. You know, it gets to a certain time of day, you just can't read another goddamn poem. You just can't do it. And so the video game is a nice way to bring that in. So that's part of it. And that's kind of the broad answer. The really practical answer is that having a video game is another piece of fictional art inside the world of this book. Let me dig much deeper into the Hollow Earth stuff than I would have if it had just been the TV show. Because at first I was just trying to make the show carry everything. And that required building out so much lore of the show that at that point I might as well have written the damn show. And I really didn't want to do that.
Did you start like writing some of the episodes or maybe episode descriptions?
At one point I wrote an episode guide. Yeah, it was going to be, I wrote an episode guide for the first season and then I was going to do all three seasons. And then I just thought this is lunacy. So I stopped. But some of the stuff that didn't make it into that, I put into these other things. And then I thought, oh, well, then David's worked on both projects and these things have a relationship. So it allowed me to build out in that way and get a lot more of the Hollow Earth stuff in and talk about some of the genre stuff.
Like going from the Rev Beach, the TV series, to Shibboleth Gold, the video game.
Yeah, because Shibboleth Gold is also a derivative piece of art that is trying to get out of its derivative origins and become something new. And where the TV show is like Buffy the Vampire Slayer by way of Dawson's Creek, the video game has taken a lot from Stephen King's Dark Tower books. It's taken a lot from H.P. Lovecraft, other things like that. And those are also great loves of mine. I mean, not something that I talk about very often or that I'm particularly known for in my own work. You wouldn't see a lot of Stephen King in my short stories or whatever, but that stuff is right there in my DNA. And so it was really nice to bust out and play with it. And then the last thing I'll say, the one video game in particular that I always have to give credit to is Hades. Brilliant game from a company called Supergiant that had been around for years, but during the pandemic became this kind of surprise smash hit. That's when I discovered it. I played it for the first time when they ported it to Switch. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with it. I don't even know how many hundreds of hours I put into it. I would play it for 3, 4, 5 hours a night, some nights, just obsessively doing runs, because the game is in runs. You have to take a run through the complete cycle, and it takes about an hour if you get all the way to the end, and if you die early, you start over, always starting over. And so it's a game about difference and repetition. It's a game about failure and rebooting. And I became obsessed with it, and I think the logic of that game is very, very deep in the logic of this novel. You know, these things really spoke to each other, and I would even say the book is divided into three parts. Each one is in a different part of the country. And that is taken directly from, in Hades, you go through these three major biomes, as they call them. You start deep in the underworld, and then you go through the Lake of Fire, and then you go through the kind of Garden of Heroes or whatever, this other weird place. And yeah, and I mean, I just took that structure wholesale. I mean, it's three acts, you know. I guess they didn't invent three-act structure, but...
And here they're all familiar geographical locations for you. In Reboot, you have Portland and Los Angeles in part one, Brooklyn and Manhattan in part two, and then Florida, you say?
Yeah.
Both coasts.
Yeah, yeah. So
the Atlantic coast and the Gulf coast in part three.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because it is kind of a, you know, like I said before, the book's always in motion. David's always in motion.
Yes.
It's a book about motion. And so he moves from part to part to different parts of the country. And it is actually a kind of reverse autobiography. He starts on the West Coast where I live now, goes back through New York where I lived, and then ends up in Florida where I grew up. But within each part too, there's also a movement, as you so rightly pointed out. You know, he goes from Portland to LA, and that's the first movement. And then when he gets to New York, he has to get from Queens where the airport is to Brooklyn to see his friend, and then they have to go to Manhattan to get away from this flood. And then when he gets to Florida, he has, for various reasons, has to fly into the East Coast where his mother lives and then drive across the Everglades to go where he needs to get to.
Yeah, that sense of movement. Well, you have kind of a funny reference in here, a stage musical of Don DeLillo's Cosmopolis, which you made up, the kind of the high and the low culture there. And Cosmopolis is that kind of in motion trip just across Manhattan. But
the full length of 47th Street from the UN to the West Side Highway.
But you get a whole book out of that, or DeLillo did.
Mm-hmm.
The cultural references, it's almost a torrent in the book. So we talked about Coleridge, Rilke's in there. And then you mentioned Buffy, the Vampire Slayer, and Dawson's Creek. You got the high and the low. And then you blend them at times with this Cosmopolis stage musical. But also you mentioned a shot-for-shot remake of The King of Marvin Gardens, this great Jack Nicholson film. but the remake is James Franco and Zendaya, which yes. is just ridiculous. But maybe it will happen one day. I don't even know if there's a distinction anymore between high and low culture. What would be the criteria?
I mean, that's a great question.
They study Zendaya in school, I'm sure. I know when I went to college, there were Madonna classes.
Yeah, well, and you can take a Taylor Swift class at Harvard. I mean,
why not? Yeah.
As maybe you should be. I mean, you know, depending how it's framed, I think we have often when we think about the Academy in the abstract, we have very narrow ideas about what it's supposed to do. But I think the old days of kind of teaching the classical canon in the ivory tower.
Right, the Western canon.
Yeah, I mean, they're long behind us to the point where, you know, there's actually some movement, quite reasonably, I think, to bring some of it back because people miss it. But you can study a lot of contemporary literature and contemporary art at the university in both English departments and creative writing departments, which I think is as it should be. And I think the distinction between high and low is in some ways blurrier than it's ever been.
It seems to be for me, I know.
Because it's less defined by genre or other kind of traditional markers of those things, and it's more defined by somebody's perception of quality. You know, if you think something achieves a level of excellence within whatever its genre is or whatever its medium is, then you can make an argument for it.
Yeah, it was easy to kind of dismiss TV.
Right.
But now some of the greatest greatest works of art come out on TV. We're watching on Netflix now Ripley, which started as Patricia Highsmith book.
Sure, and passed through film and is now into television. And
yeah,
why should it, you know,
but
maybe
this latest
be
version
musical.
Is beautifully done, beautifully acted. I would not call it low culture. It's a cut above Dawson's Creek.
yeah, and you know, and I don't know that I don't think of Dawson's Creek as high art. I mean,
no,
you know, but that
I'm just saying you can't dismiss a whole genre.
No, absolutely not. Well, listen, I mean, there are episodes of Buffy I would call high art. Maybe even entire seasons. I mean, I don't know about the whole run, but
right. Who could argue with that?
But I think, you know, I think especially some of those later seasons, there's a real beauty to what they're doing. And I think one of the things that's interesting about television in particular that makes it almost unique among the art forms is because it goes on so long sometimes.
Seasons, not just limited series.
Decades. Mm-hmm. You know, Simpsons has been on almost 40 years now.
Yeah.
At a certain point, all those shows become about themselves. And they become about trying not to do what they've already done. And they really become about a certain kind of fan service where you're trying to keep with you the people that have been with you all along, and you're relying on their deep knowledge of where you've already been. And the only other example that's like that I can really think of is bands. You know, you go to see a band on their 30th anniversary tour, maybe someone's there for the first time, but a lot of people are there because they've been coming for 30 years.
Well, we mentioned your article on Phish.
Which I wrote about, you know, basically about their then upcoming 40th anniversary, which now is last year. Yeah, you know, that music, that experience has been a huge part of my life. I've been going to see them since I'm 17, you know?
And I've been a deadhead. I saw them back in England in 1974, I think. It was my first time.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I love the... I mean, I've listened to The Dead as long as Phish, and, you know, I never got to see them live with Garcia, but even so, there are 30 years of my listening wrapped up in that experience.
Well, when you talk to a deadhead, I'm sure it's like talking to a Phish fan.
Sure.
You know, they can tell you what they played on a certain date. They haven't played this song in 4 years. Or they changed this or they changed that. They don't do the same set list twice. I mean, it can go on and on when you meet a fan of the band like that. So yeah, it's its own kind of almost religion or mythology.
And I think serial television is one of the places that you really see another version of that. I mean, maybe film franchises, you know, there are people who just love every Fast and Furious or, you know, they're like John Wick heads or something. But I don't know. It still just feels a little different to me because like playing concerts night after night, TV is a volume business. You know, even the high art TV, we've been talking about Ripley or The Sopranos, you know, The Wire. A lot of those were 8-10 episode seasons. Maybe they ran for 6 or 7 years. It's still actually not that many hours. You know, you think of something like Game of Thrones that was a cultural phenomenon for a decade. If you add up all 7 season, 8 seasons of Game of Thrones, whatever it is, in just terms of running time, it's like maybe two seasons of Buffy, maybe two and a half. They just have so many minutes to fill. And, you know, some of them get really bad and silly because of that. But some of them end up doing really interesting things that you could never do in a 90-minute movie, in a 300-page novel. It wouldn't occur to you.
And I mean, if you don't, you got the fans picking up. Right. Fan fiction plays a big part.
Absolutely.
In your book, in Reboot. And, I mean, you could even apply it to music. I'm sure there's Phish cover bands. I know there's hundreds of thousands of Grateful Dead cover bands in every city that I've been in. It's just incredible. That's the fans picking up where the band is not delivering or has stopped.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love cover songs, whether that's, you know, the several hundred songs that the Dead covered in the course of their career. And for me, they're really the benchmark of understanding performance and interpretation as the nexus of creativity, that's just as valuable as writing your own thing.
And I think they're both integral.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean,
when they're covering bluegrass or blues or rock, even something like Chuck Berry, those influences go into their original songs too.
Sure.
And I'm sure Phish is the same way.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot of Zapp in there and some Dead, but incredible, more funk than the Dead.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think with modern fandom culture and this culture of fan fiction, there's a link to that same idea to a certain point. And I think I understand why people do it and how it helps them participate. But I also think it's a very contemporary phenomenon in the way that it's gotten so big and so pervasive. And it forces the owners of the intellectual property to walk a very fine line, because they want fans to feel so engaged that they will write this stuff, and they want fans to be so rabid that you can activate your Swifties at the drop of a hat and get 100,000 tweets in 10 minutes. But they don't want those people to feel so much ownership that they think they have a decision about what happens, or that they think they're entitled to some of the profit from, you know, from
there's,
the sale
there's
of the
IP
work
involved.
Right. And so, you know, it's a very touchy thing. You know, you want people to come out at midnight dressed as their favorite Harry Potter character and buy four copies of the book instead of one. Maybe you even want them to write their own, you know, Harry Potter fan fiction about what Harry and Hermione did on their gap year. You don't super want them to write sex stories about a bunch of 16-year-olds like
doing erotic
magic at each other, and you definitely don't want them selling those things.
But right? Red Beach, the fans are writing erotic fan fiction about David and Shane and Grace.
Huh? Yeah, and so David has an interesting relationship with the fan base. He doesn't interact directly with too many of them, but there's something he's known about his whole life. He's aware that they're out there, and he's actually looked at some of the stuff that they've produced, and I think he doesn't mind that it's out there as long as he doesn't have to really think about it, because he recognizes in a certain pragmatic way that there's a relationship between those people wanting to do that and read that on their own time and the fact that he's been paid money to sit here and sign autographs at this fan convention. And then that's enough for him. And different people have different relationships to that kind of fandom in the book. You know, Grace, who in the novel is become a kind of Gwyneth Paltrow, Busy Phillips.
She started off as a Tori Spelling and morphed into Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, and so she's running a lifestyle brand, and she does product placement and Instagram stuff right. all day from her personal care line. And she is someone who normally would not look at any of the comments, would just know better, would never do it. But in fact, she does. She's genuinely interested in not even in so much what people have to say, but in the weirdness of finding herself so close. And there are certain, like, serial creep reply guys that she has.
Oh, the guy that wants to know her foot size.
Yeah, yeah, Big Dodge and his energy. You know, she would never talk to him. She knows enough to be wary of him. But it's kind of interesting to her that he exists and that he's almost a daily part of her life. Like, she knows if she posts something,
social media is like that, huh?
He's going to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even though she would never acknowledge him because she doesn't want to encourage him, she feels very seen by him in a certain way. You know, he's a kind of weird secret sharer in a strange, perverted way.
And he also plays a big part in the book, indirectly at least.
Yeah.
So without giving too much away, I have a question that I was really curious about. We talked, the book eventually became a first-person narrative, a memoir of this fictional character, David Crater, the child actor, written in first-person throughout. But it starts off with a short section, just a few pages long, called Cold Open. And it's more like a preface with the pages not even numbered in integers. It's in Roman numerals. And this is in the third person from a different character's point of view, not David's. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not sure, Justin, how much you want to talk about, since that character's identity isn't really clear until the end of the novel.
Yeah.
And you got to kind of think about it a little. But I'm curious for your reasons starting with Cold Open like that. It's it adds a very ominous tone to the novel.
Yeah, it does. And I hope it was worth the risk. We had some back and forth about whether or not to include it. And when I was reading the audiobook, actually, that was the moment that it really hit me, where I was sort of like, oh, this is a rough entry. You know, here I wrote this very welcoming, user-friendly chapter one. Let's get to know this guy. He's right. Telling a story. And then I slapped this thing in front of it. It was, I think of it as a kind of overture to the novel. It has a lot of the major themes. It introduces a lot of the kind of rhetoric that the novel will use. And this is something that you see a lot in DeLillo, who is one of the major inspirations for this. You know, you think about the first section of Mao Tu, the first section of Underworld, you know, that long...
Oh, that's Pavko at the Wall. Yeah.
You know, he does versions of this kind of a lot, and I really like that. I think the other reason that I put it in there was... Although the bulk of the novel is David's memoir, and he's very open about that fact, I wanted there to be a little bit of a gap between the book you are buying and the celebrity memoir that he's writing. Because if those things were exactly coterminous, I would have put his name on the cover and like credited myself as the co-author and done a more kind of metafiction thing. And I didn't do that, right? So 97% of the novel is this textual document that is his memoir, his tell-all. But there are these other things floating in there that are mine, and that should, you know, most of the book is about suspension of disbelief, but these should maybe kind of push the other way.
Oh, I loved it.
They should remind you that you're seeing something
staged
and artificial.
I mean, I like that era of mystery. Yeah.
Good. I'm glad you did.
Yeah, and again, it adds a tone to it that comes back later in the book. I mean, it's somewhat comical. It's not silly. I wouldn't even call even the comedy silly. You know, it's very clever comedy, but it adds something to it—a kind of a like a seriousness. Boy, I can't really think of the right word, but something underlying it all that isn't so happy and bright and joyful, and it's like the world we live in.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of dread in this novel. Mm-hmm. There's a real strong sense of doom. David is often talking about, you know, apocalypses that have come and gone, things he's gotten away with.
Yes, and there's apocalypses in every place he goes.
Yeah.
There's wildfires, there's floods. In Florida, there's a huge sinkhole.
Yeah, he's...
a whole Margaritaville hotel, I think, is swallowed up.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, it's on his mind because it's real. I mean, the same way that it's on our minds. You know?
Right, and you talked before how you have love for certain authors like H.P. Lovecraft that doesn't always come out in your work, but you edited an anthology, it came out in 2007, called The Apocalypse Reader. That includes stories about the end of the world from 34 writers, some more modern ones, the contemporary Kelly Link, Ursula Le Guin, the late Le Guin, but she died just a few years ago, Neil Gaiman, but also Hawthorne, H.G. Wells, H.P. Lovecraft, Edgar Allan Poe. And that must have been a big influence on Reboot, which is rife with all these apocalypses. I think, in a way, it is the apocalypse reader. And you talk about, a climate event or climate collapse.
Yeah.
But there's also other events in there, a political, a push towards the right, towards fascism in there. A lot of apocalyptic theories going on and stories in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that is something that is on all of our minds these days. It's certainly something that's been on my mind.
The end of the world, yes.
Yeah, for a very long time. You know, I think I've written about it in a lot of different ways. And because I'm someone who often ends up writing in some way about, you know, religion, you know, every religion has some kind of eschatology. But yeah, I mean, actually, when I started grad school in the mid-2000s, I'd had this idea of doing a book of short stories that all contained the end of the world in them. The world ended in every single story.
In a different way each
time. In a different way. That project failed. It was a very naive idea in certain ways. But what came out of it was I realized I didn't have 15 apocalypse stories in me, but almost every writer had one. And so I just started...
And here you found 34.
I just started collecting them. Uh-huh. You know, some of them from friends that I knew or writers who I could get in touch with. Some I pulled just out of the public domain. You know, that was all the names that you cited. And I tried to make something that was mostly contemporary, but also had a bit of a sense of history. And I just did the best I could. I mean, it was the first book I ever had my name on. And it was just this thing that I got lucked my way into getting hired to edit. They paid me a few $1,000s. I spent a summer doing it and, you know, had no idea. And so I think it, you know, there's parts of it that I'm still proud of. There's things I would do differently, whatever. But yeah, I mean, this idea of apocalypse in my life is at least that old, if not older. And I should say, too, it wasn't that the every story apocalypse idea was bad in itself. It was just that I couldn't do it. There's one of the authors in that book, Lucy Corin, she gave me, I think it was 15 small apocalypses or however many are in there. She was writing these flash fictions about the end of the world, and she gave me a batch of them. Well, she ended up writing the book that I couldn't, you know, her 100 apocalypses and other apocalypses.
And the world ending in different ways.
Yeah. It was published by McSweeney's some years ago now, but it's a great book. I mean, you know, she did it. It's worth checking out.
Now, one last question.
Sure.
I don't know if you've optioned the film rights for a reboot yet, but you do have a screenplay in production called The Last Days of Basic Cable. So again, kind of TV centric. Is there anything you can say about that that's not covered by a non-disclosure agreement?
Yeah, sure. The Last Days of Basic Cable is an original screenplay that my dear friend, the novelist Adam Wilson, and I co-wrote. It came out of the same sessions in 2014 when I first started this novel. He and I had gone on a trip to start new books, and we were working in different rooms in this place in the Berkshires that his family had let us use. And so we would sit by ourselves all day and try to start these new novels, and then we would get together at night and just make a fire and have a couple drinks and bullshit. And out of that back and forth, we started making these characters and drafting this story that became this screenplay. It's a kind of, this will sound ridiculous, but it's a kind of Y2K rom-com.
Kind of an apocalyptic story? Or?
No, I mean, there's a little bit of Y2K fever in it, but nothing too bad. It's set in a college town, basically between Halloween and New Year's of 1999. And these two guys who've just graduated are seeing these two girls that are finishing up. And so it's a little bit of like a Whit Stillman kicking and screaming by way of a certain kind of 1990s lowish brow comedy that doesn't really get done anymore. Like a Reality Bites or Mallrats. God forgive me for saying that. So yeah, we wrote it and, you know, we had languished for a number of years. And then in 2020, when Adam, who finished his book, a wonderful novel called Sensation Machines, he was taking some meetings about maybe adapting that. And he met with a director named Max Winkler, who ended up not wanting to do that, but asked him, what else do you have? And Adam showed him the Basic Cable script. And Max got excited about it and introduced us to our production partners. And the five of us have been kind of chiseling away at this thing ever since. We have a full cast. We have 3/4 of a budget. And as soon as we have an option, as soon as we plug that last hole in the budget, they're going to go shoot the thing. So if anyone listening wants to produce about 1/4 of a movie, it's a great time to put your name on it. Just say the word. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me anywhere you can find me.
No, Justin, thanks so much for talking with us today. I want to leave kind of on an apocalyptic note with a few closing words from Reboot. And since you narrated the audiobook, I wondered if you could please read that for us.
Sure. Where will you be when your apocalypse comes calling? Will you see it bearing down on you from a distance, filling the horizon and sky like a fire or like God? Will it rise up from beneath you like flood water, or burst forth from within like pent-up love? Will you run or bid welcome? Will you know its name? And, more important, will it know yours?
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again. You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Justin Taylor, author of the new novel Reboot from Pantheon Books. Justin will be appearing at Powell's City of Books in downtown Portland, along with Julia Hannafin, his former student, tomorrow, Friday, May 10th at 7 p.m. You can find out more about Justin, his work, and all his upcoming events online at justintaylor.net. Just a note that KABU is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. It's our spring membership drive, so there's no better time to show your support for the station and programming like this by becoming a member yourself or renewing your membership. Just go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month, usually from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, May 23rd at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
they say the user lives outside the net and inputs games for pleasure. No one knows for sure, but I intend to find out.
Reboot!